Citizen Sounds, a diverse collection of sounds and stories from our researchers, educators, and students, sharing knowledge and insight to make a difference in Leicester and the world. We are Citizens of Change, University of Leicester. I'm Tree King, Professor of Public Engagement at the University of Leicester, and today I'm talking to Emma Bunce, who is Professor of Planetary Plasma Physics, as well as being Head of School of Physics and Astronomy. We'll be talking about Emma's various research projects, but first of all, Emma, tell me about your background. How did you come to be interested in space?
When I was younger, I was always interested in just looking up at the sky. I can remember from a very young age that I wanted a telescope, you know, probably from like 8 or 9, something like that. Always fascinated looking at the moon, staring at the sky, getting neck ache. But as I got a little bit older, I suppose I got a little bit more seriously interested in it, in the sense that when I went to secondary school, we were starting to learn a bit more detail about what the sciences were, the different sciences, what physics actually was, and obviously doing a lot more maths and things. And so I kind of really enjoyed those subjects. Not going to say that I was the best at them, but I certainly enjoyed them. And around the same time, there was a sort of key thing that happened in terms of space missions, and that served as a big sort of inspiration for me. And that was the Voyager mission, which had been launched in the 1970s, two spacecraft that were on this incredible journey through the solar system, a sort of once in 180-year opportunity to send spacecraft past multiple planets. So when I was in secondary school, it was the turn of Neptune to have its flyby. And I just remember watching Horizon, and watching the Horizon program, it sort of changed my view of what these missions were about and what they were for and what it actually meant to people. And so in the Horizon program, it had a shot of all these scientists, probably at JPL, I would imagine. Some of them I now actually know, which is the really funny part. And they were looking at this data that was coming back from Neptune and saw these pictures of Neptune, this beautiful blue planet with storms in the atmosphere and everything. And there's just these scientists, room full of scientists, cheering and really excited. And it sort of really hit home to me how amazing that was to get images back like that, that nobody on the planet has ever seen. But also, I suppose, from a practical level, it then occurred to me that these people were actually getting paid to do that. That was a job. And I thought, well, that's incredible. So maybe that's a job I could do. And that sort of led to a series of events and me writing a letter to NASA. I don't know what I was thinking, really. Just sat down, wrote a letter and sent it off to them and said, that looks amazing. And can you tell me how it is that I get to do a job like that, really? And they wrote back to me with all this advice, and which I thought was incredible, and I still think is incredible, that they wrote back, and the letter contained lots of really helpful, practical information about what I needed to do, which was, in essence, study science and maths, go to university, do a degree, maybe get a PhD, and then see where that takes you. You know, that was a really huge source of inspiration, actually.
I love that NASA wrote back to you.
I know.
And they're like nurturing that that interest.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's fabulous. So I know you did. You came here and you at the University of Leicester and you did your undergraduate degree and then your PhD. So what brought you to Leicester and where did your research career kind of start? What area?
So what brought me to Leicester in the first place as an undergraduate was that I was following on that path of what I wanted to study. And Leicester at the time were running a new physics with space science and technology degree. I think it was, I was the second year group to start that degree. And at the end of that course, you get to do the sort of research projects. And you have an opportunity to work closely with a member of staff and really get a chance to sort of delve into a bit more of the details of the research fields that staff in the physics department work on. So I had a couple of interesting projects that I did, one of which was with Stan Cowley, who was one of my lecturers at the time. He was teaching us advanced space plasma physics in the fourth year, which was a fantastic course, and I really enjoyed that. And I did a project with him, and I did another project with another member of staff about creating a new mission. So it's like a, what we call a phase A study. So the initial study that you do to justify why NASA or the European Space Agency, ESA, would send a mission somewhere. So I had these sort of really kind of in-depth opportunities to study a little bit more about those things that I'd always been interested in. you know, plasma environments, space environments of planets, and then missions to planets. And of course, I created a mission to a planet. And that sort of led me to thinking that maybe I could apply to do a PhD. So I had a few doubts, but I applied anyway. And then I had the opportunity to do a PhD with Stan. And, you know, we were sort of discussing what topics we could do. He was working at the time mainly on the terrestrial, you know, our own space environment. But I chatted to him about the fact that he'd been previously working on the outer planets. And we had long discussions about how, you know, maybe that could be something that I could work on. And in the end, he agreed and said, you know, we could pursue a project on Jupiter. And so then I started studying Jupiter's space environment, so magnetic field and extended region of the space environment called the magnetosphere.
So you've been talking about this already. Like, one of the key kind of focus around planetary research is often around magnetic fields. So what are they? Why are they important? Do all planets have them?
These are good questions. So the magnetic field is very important. So often when we're talking about planetary science, I think it's good to sort of bring it back to our own planet. You know, fundamentally, that's what inspires us, really, because we want to know about our own environment. So magnetic fields are generated deep within the core of a planet. So the Earth has its own magnetic field generated by currents flowing in the sort of liquid metallic iron core of the Earth. And we understand reasonably well about how that works and how that's generated on our own planet. We also know that the magnetic field at the Earth is fundamental to life on Earth. If we didn't have a magnetic field, we wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation, because the magnetic field and extended region of space known as the magnetosphere actually protects us from the sun's harmful radiation, and it stops our atmosphere from being stripped away by the solar wind. So it's fundamental to our existence. You know, the fact that we have a magnetic field is critical. And so if you want to understand magnetic fields in general, then testing your ideas and theories about how these things work in other laboratories, i.e. at other planets, is really important. And so it turns out that quite a few planets in the solar system also have magnetic fields. And so we can go through a list of them, but Jupiter has the strongest of all those magnetic fields in the solar system. And it's probably, as far as we know so far, almost, you know, the most complex in some ways. And that's being studied by missions currently. And so we can learn a great deal about the interior of the planet, because that's where the field is generated. But as it extends beyond the confines of the planet itself and extends out into space in huge distances into this magnetosphere structure, it is controlled then by various different interactions that take place and creates other interesting phenomena like the aurora that we see in the Earth's atmosphere, for example. So there's very practical reasons why we need to study them. So from our own perspective, if we want, you know, satellites to operate in near-Earth space, which we fundamentally rely on in the modern world, then we need to understand how our magnetic field and magnetosphere work, how they're affected by the sun and the interaction between the sun and the planet. And that's sort of a topic known as space weather. So that's really critically important to us.
So yeah, so you just mentioned about solar wind. So, okay, so tell me about solar wind.
Yeah, okay. So solar wind is a plasma which flows constantly outwards from the sun. You can think of plasma as being the fourth state of matter. You know, when we study physics back in secondary school, we learn about solids, liquids and gases, the basics of materials that we learn about. But plasma is the fourth state of matter, and it's actually the most abundant form of matter in the universe. You know, 99% of the universe is in the plasma state. So it's pretty important that we understand how they work. So fundamentally, you get from a gas to a plasma by adding heat. So if you heat a gas, it's actually possible to strip electrons from neutral atoms, leaving positive ions and negative electrons that form a plasma gas, which is energetic. And then, you know, in the case of the sun, that happens at the very top layers of the atmosphere in a region called the corona, which is unbelievably hot and is able to provide that heat that creates a plasma that then actually is so energetic that it flows away from the sun and fills our solar system and heliosphere, which is a sort of the sun's equivalent of our magnetosphere. But because the solar cycle actually exists and we have various activity which relates to things like sunspots and solar flares, then the solar wind is not just a constant stream, it's actually quite dynamic. And sometimes it can be very active and sometimes it can be very quiet. So it's a little bit like the weather in the sense that it can be, you know, stormy, but it can also have a very calm day. So that plasma then flows outwards from the sun, and the nature of plasmas and magnetic fields is that they stick together. And so the plasma, actually the solar wind, drags the sun's magnetic field outwards with it, and that fills the whole of our solar system and creates the heliosphere, which is the sort of sun's equivalent of the magnetosphere. And so when that solar wind, carrying the sun's magnetic field, which we call the interplanetary magnetic field, when that reaches a planet with its own magnetic field, it then interacts and forms this cavity known as the magnetosphere. So it squashes the planet's magnetic field on one side, where it first touches the planet's region of space with its own magnetic field. And then as it flows past, it stretches it right out into a long magnetic tail that can stretch, you know, for huge distances beyond the planet, downstream of that flow of solar wind.
What's planetary plasma physics then?
So planetary plasma physics then sort of follows on from that discussion about the solar wind and its magnetic field that's filling the whole of our solar system. So planetary plasma physics then speaks to those planets which have magnetic fields, which then have their own magnetospheres, the extended region of space that contains the planet's magnetic field. And it is the subject which describes how those environments operate. So again, important for us is to understand how our own planetary plasma environment works. And we understand that quite well because we live in it and we spend time studying it. And that's really important. And so we know in the case of the Earth that the dominant process which occurs is that interaction between the sun, so the sun's magnetic field and plasma, and the Earth's magnetic field. And the interaction that takes place is pretty amazing, and it happens at the front of the magnetosphere, the first point of contact between the solar wind and the planet's magnetic field. And a process known as magnetic reconnection can take place. And that actually then drives a process of dynamics within the Earth's magnetosphere, driven by that solar wind interaction and the solar wind flowing past. And it creates a cycle, and it's known as the Dungey cycle, actually. And Jim Dungey was Stan Cowley's PhD supervisor. So this whole process that we know that operates at the Earth is sort of predominantly to do with this solar wind interaction. So we understand the Earth pretty well. But you then naturally ask the question about, well, how does it work somewhere else? You know, does it work like that at Jupiter, for example? Jupiter has a field which is significantly stronger than the Earth's, something like 60 times stronger, I think, at the planet's surface, the magnetic field strength. And the magnetosphere is, you know, absolutely enormous in comparison to the Earth's magnetosphere. And so a good question is, well, how does that work? So actually part of this was what I did for my PhD work with Stan. And it turns out that Jupiter, it has aurora. There's an aurora in the atmosphere that if you just look at the images of the aurora, you could think, well, it looks quite similar to the Earth. You know, there are bands of aurora that go around both poles, and we've seen those using telescopes, Hubble Space Telescope, for example. And so you could look at that and you could think, well, maybe that tells us that it's the same. But unless you go there and you measure the plasma, the magnetic field, you don't really know how it works. And it turns out at Jupiter that there is an additional effect which is really key, and that is the moon Io, strangely enough. So Jupiter has four famous moons, the Galilean moons, Io, Europa, Ganymede and Callisto. And Io is the closest moon to Jupiter. And through strong gravitational interaction between Io and Jupiter, there's tidal heating going on. So the moon is actually flexing, and it has an amplitude of a tidal effect, which is about 100 metres. It flexes the surface by that amount as Io orbits around Jupiter. And that heats the interior and causes active volcanoes to be present on that moon. So it has hundreds of active volcanoes, and it then spits out all of this material into the environment around Jupiter. That material is initially neutral material, so atoms coming from within volcanoes. But eventually, that material is photoionized, so it is actually, again, turns into a plasma. And that plasma then interacts with Jupiter's magnetic field and creates a mechanism that accounts for Jupiter's aurora.
So you also work on planetary exploration and solar system missions such as Juno, which is looking at Jupiter, and BepiColombo, which is looking at Mercury. So tell me about those ones.
Okay, so Juno is a NASA mission to Jupiter, and it's a really exciting mission in the sense that it's the first spacecraft to go into a polar orbit around Jupiter. So previous missions that have visited the planet, the Voyager flybys and then the Galileo mission, those missions were near to the equator of the planet. And the Galileo mission, named because it was going to understand the Galilean moons in more detail. So Juno is different in that its orbit takes it over the poles, and it's the first time that any spacecraft has done that. The closer you get to the planet, the better measurements you get of its internally driven magnetic field. So again, the complexity in the magnetic field can tell you where within the planet that field is being generated. And you can also see, image and probe the atmosphere with instruments really well if you're in that polar orbit. So the really close part of the orbit goes from pole to pole in just a few hours and is a few thousand kilometres above the cloud tops of Jupiter. So a really fantastic view for atmospheric instruments, let's say, probing the constituents of Jupiter's atmosphere. From my perspective, it's interesting because if you go from pole to pole very close to Jupiter, then actually you're cutting through all of the magnetic field lines that kind of map to the whole of that magnetosphere that we've talked about, the huge magnetosphere. And crucially, you cut through the magnetic field lines, which are carrying the electric current which produces the aurora. And so for us here in Leicester, that's our key reason to be involved, actually. So the work that we did started for my PhD work and then has been continued by other researchers in our group for many years. This was our first opportunity to test out our ideas about how that aurora generation mechanism works. And in the meantime, in the sort of 20 years intervening between my PhD and Juno, roughly 20 years, you know, we've created models that could actually be tested against data. And so that's what we've been doing with the Juno data as well. So that's why we're interested in the mission.
So BepiColombo, you've talked about this a lot already, but I have to ask you. So BepiColombo has been going to Mercury.
Yes, completely different. Completely different. Well, in some ways, a completely different topic, but there is an interesting twist. So the BepiColombo mission is now almost a third of the way through its journey to Mercury, which is fantastic. It launched back in 2018 on a 7-year journey before it starts its science mission in 2025 when it gets to Mercury. And the key thing for us here in Leicester is that we have built, or the team have built, an instrument. Just to explain what the instrument is, it's the Mercury Imaging X-ray Spectrometer. So it kind of exactly describes what it does. In simple terms, I would say it is like a camera, but instead of operating at visible wavelengths, which is what our sort of phone cameras or regular cameras that we use would operate at, it's looking at the surface in X-ray wavelengths. And there's a very specific reason why we do that. And it's to utilize a technique called X-ray fluorescence, which is something that our undergraduates do in the lab, and I'm sure many undergraduates do in the various sciences, because it's a really well-used technique in laboratories for working out what things are made of. But in space, it's quite different, the way that that X-ray fluorescence comes about. And again, it comes back to the sun. So the sun emits X-ray photons, and those X-ray photons, again, sometimes they're quiet and sometimes there are more of them. So depending if there's a solar flare, for example. And those X-ray photons actually then interact directly with Mercury's surface and create this process called X-ray fluorescence, whereby an individual atom on the surface can emit another X-ray photon, which our instrument will measure. But crucially, it has the energy, which is like a fingerprint of which atom it came from. So effectively, what we can do with the instrument is build up maps and spectra, so actual images, but also spectra, that tell us about the composition of Mercury's surface. And we have two components to the instrument. So we have the sort of wide-angle lens and the zoom lens, if you see what I mean. So we can look on a global scale with one part of the instrument and build up a sort of coarse map of what that composition is across the surface of Mercury, whilst the spacecraft is in its orbit around Mercury. And the other part of the instrument, which is like the zoom lens, allows us to kind of get in and see much higher resolution detail. So the highest resolution could be down at the level of a few kilometers per pixel across an image, which means that we could look at an individual decent sized crater and be able to say something about the composition of the materials on the surface across the feature. So that's a really exciting instrument, incredibly exciting for the team here in Leicester to be, well, on the receiving end of that data set that's going to come back to us that belongs to Leicester. You know, it's we're the principal investigator institute, which means that we get that data. Obviously, we work with a large international team. The instrument is not just made of components that come from Leicester. It's an international collaboration. But fundamentally, we're sort of responsible for the instrument and we will lead the science team when the mission starts. So that's incredibly exciting. And it turns out there is also a link back to my sort of magnetosphere interests as well, because one of the things that we've worked on here over the last few years is looking at a previous mission called MESSENGER that showed that there was X-ray emission coming from the night side surface of Mercury. So that isn't the same technique that I've just described there. So where the sun is shining on the surface, you get that X-ray fluorescence, but on the dark side, you don't get that process. But the MESSENGER data showed that you do get an X-ray emission coming from that surface. And one of our postdocs here, Simon Lindsay, analysed all of that data from the MESSENGER mission and mapped out where the emission was coming from and found that it's organised by Mercury's magnetic field. It hints of the sort of equivalent of an aurora. But obviously, at Mercury, there's no atmosphere. So it's not a glow that's coming from an atmosphere. It's potentially particles that are directly impacting with the surface and creating the X-ray emission that we're seeing. But that organisation by the magnetic field is really key for this, because it tells us that it's a magnetosphere process and a fairly unique situation of a magnetosphere interacting with a surface and creating this X-ray emission. So we've got sort of two sides to our science objectives. The main purpose of the instrument is the composition of the surface, and that will tell us a huge amount about Mercury and hopefully will help people pin down theories of how the planet was formed, and it'll help us to understand how the planet's evolved. It'll tell us about individual features on the surface and give us a huge amount of information on the global scale, which is beyond what any instrument at Mercury has done before. And then on the other hand, we've got this exciting new topic, really, that hasn't really been studied in great detail before by any previous mission. And so that's a really exciting opportunity.
Okay, so tell us about this really interesting project that you're working on at the moment. This is around Jupiter's moons, which you've chatted a little bit about already, but you've got one coming up. It's a launch in 2022, isn't it?
That's right. So it's the Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer mission, known as JUICE, which is the worst acronym.
Oh, it's a great acronym.
I can tell you a funny story about that another time.
Yeah, anyway, do. Yeah.
But the JUICE mission is incredibly exciting for so many reasons. For me, it's exciting personally because I was involved from almost the very beginning. And I was invited by the European Space Agency to join the international team of scientists that was going to prepare the proposal for a new large class mission. And it's, in fact, it's ESA's first large class mission. So that was a really exciting invitation, which I took up, obviously, very enthusiastically. And so, you know, the job was to sort of think about what the science objectives for a mission to Jupiter to explore the icy moons. So the focus of the mission is on Ganymede. Now, there are multiple moons within the system which are incredibly exciting. So I've spoken a little bit about Io and its volcanoes. So you can imagine the challenges of sending a spacecraft there. There's Europa, which everybody has heard of, I'm sure. It's more commonly perhaps known that Europa is a very exciting target for reasons that we are fairly confident that it has a global ocean underneath its icy crust. Very exciting. Ganymede, the next one along, is a bigger moon, and we think it also has a subsurface ocean, but it also has a magnetic field all of its own. And that's, as far as we know, unique in the solar system so far. It's the only moon to have its own magnetic field, actually really similar to Mercury. So Ganymede and Mercury are about the same size. Ganymede's actually a bit bigger. And it has a magnetic field which is of similar strength to Mercury's magnetic field. So there's some really interesting kind of parallels that you can draw between those two objects. But Ganymede, the moon, sits within Jupiter's magnetic field. It has its own magnetic field. And then Jupiter's magnetic field is the planet rotates, the magnetic field rotates, and Jupiter's magnetic field then interacts with Ganymede's magnetic field. So instead of the Sun and a planet's magnetic field interacting, in this instance, we've got Jupiter's magnetic field and Ganymede's magnetic field interacting. That creates a little miniature magnetosphere within a magnetosphere. So Ganymede has its own dynamic little magnetosphere. And it also has, you know, in its fairly tenuous atmosphere, Ganymede also has aurora, which we've seen from images, again, using Hubble Space Telescope. So there's all this really exciting science going on at Ganymede. So the JUICE mission focuses on that moon. But the subsurface ocean element is a really important part of this mission. It's the driver for this mission, really. And the prospect of there being a subsurface ocean underneath an icy crust in the outer solar system, we now think there are multiple of them, Saturn in the Saturn system too, possibly beyond in Neptune's environment, for example, is really tantalizing, right? Because we know that we need water in order for there to be life. At least that's our understanding of how the laws of nature work on this planet. And previously, we always have thought about a sort of Goldilocks zone where the conditions are just right to be where we are in the solar system. So at the Earth's distance from the sun, the temperature's just right that water can remain a liquid on the surface. And, you know, that works for us. And hence we, you know, crawled out the swamp and all of that. And then we look for the evidence of whether there has been water on Mars and possibly whether there are still stores of water underneath the surface, for example. And of course, that's a very exciting topic. And Mars as a habitable object has always been of great interest. And then the Galileo mission, which was back in the 1990s, goes out to the outer solar system, to Jupiter, and measures various different things. So, you can think that the main three things that you need to understand if you want to find out if there's an ocean, interestingly, the gravitational field, because that tells you about what's going on in the inside, spectroscopy of the surface, because that tells you what the surface is made of, and Europa has kind of interesting additional chemicals on the surface, which are not just pure ice, let's say, not pure water. And also the magnetic field. So this is, again, where the magnetic field comes into it. And the magnetic field at measurements at Europa and Ganymede are actually a large part why we think there are global oceans. And it turns out that again, it's just a sort of everything falls into place and the conditions are just right for the Galileo mission to be able to have measured a signature, which scientists then have understood to be the signature of the ocean. So effectively, that is because Jupiter's magnetic field is wobbling because it doesn't align perfectly with the rotation axis. It's tilted. And so as the planet rotates around, the field wobbles up and down. And that's the driving field. And then you've got an ocean that's potentially a conducting layer. And that conducting layer is moving through the magnetic field of Jupiter, which is then wobbling up and down and changing what we call the driving field in electromagnetism. And that induces a magnetic field signature associated with the ocean that can then be measured. So the Galileo spacecraft went on flybys past the moons and measured a magnetic field signature, which was of unknown origin. But then when the spacecraft encountered that moon at different phases of that wobble of Jupiter's magnetic field, the induced field flicks from one direction to another. And that tells you that it's potentially, you know, associated with a conducting layer within the moon itself. And a logical interpretation of that is that that's a global, maybe salty, conducting ocean. And that's kind of mind-blowing, isn't it?
It is mind-blowing. It makes me think of, like, I don't know, I suppose people use the analogy of marbles for planets a lot, but this one's got, so have you got like a marble inside an ocean, inside ice?
Well, I mean...
Or do you know what the center of it is?
So this is the really... I mean, yeah, I'm going to get over-enthusiastic now. Sorry about that.
No, but I'm intrigued now because it's like...
So that's what... Yeah. Yeah, so this
What's
is why
going
it's really
there?
Exciting. So yeah. Europa is thought to have a rocky core and then an ocean and then an icy crust. And Ganymede, again, you know, to be determined, but is likely to be a rocky core, maybe with ice at the bottom, and then an ocean and then ice again. So you sort of think, well, how does all of that work? And one of the, again, amazing things about all of this is just it's the fundamental property of water. It's how water works. When water freezes and you get an ice layer, it doesn't sink to the bottom, because if it sunk to the bottom, you'd never get a subsurface ocean. Ice is actually less dense than water. So it floats to the top and then it actually protects that ocean from underneath, which then, again, with a bit of help from tidal heating, keeps warm and remains a liquid layer. And so that's tantalizing if you want to think about, okay, if we want to think about the conditions for habitability and we want water and we want heat and we're used to the heat coming from the sun, but maybe the heat can come from tidal heating and you need interesting chemistry. So if that ocean floor is interacting with rock, as we think it is at Europa, then you're starting to sort of step towards the kind of conditions that we understand on the Earth to be the kind of conditions that we know can support life. So, you know, hot smokers in the depths of oceans that receive no sunlight have living organisms. So we know it works on the Earth. So it's not a huge stretch to think that those environments could be habitable or have been habitable or maybe habitable in the future. And really then the question is, you know, how do we get to study them? What do we need to do next? And JUICE is the, you know, the way we described it in our proposal was that it was the next logical step in our exploration. Voyager went past and did initial measurements, discovered the volcanoes on Io, for example. And then Galileo went past and Galileo did multiple flybys of the moons and came up with these magnetic signatures that hint at subsurface oceans. So what do you do next? Well, you could miss out a step and go straight for a landing and try and, you know, dig through the ice, which is what people would like to do. Okay, the ice is really thick. That's not going to work very well. It's very cold out there in the outer solar system. So not as simple as that. The next step is to go and put a spacecraft into an orbit around Ganymede, which is what JUICE will end up doing. And that will allow us to closely map the surface and lots of other science as well. So studying the magnetic field, the gravitational field, but visibly imaging the surface really closely is an absolute requirement before you can think about the next step of a lander. It's certainly a future aspiration now. I mean, we had to sort of think that that was a step that was too far beyond the scope of the JUICE mission. In parallel with JUICE, there's a NASA mission going as well to study Europa. So we're actually hoping that there will be the two spacecraft there at the same time. We'll be studying Ganymede. The NASA mission will be studying Europa. And, well, I can't wait, basically. I've got to wait till 2030, but, you know.
I mean, that will bring us on to something that we could chat about in a minute, about the length of the studies that you do. But it got me thinking, because we've in my field, we think about the last universal common ancestor, which is known to be about 4 billion years old in deep sea vents. You know, so it's this idea of the early sort of start of life being in these oceans, in the dark, close to core, you know, where you get this, where you get the heat coming up from the center of the earth and creating the right conditions for life. So when you're chatting about this, I'm already thinking like, ooh, you know, so that's the hopefully, you know, could you get the start of cellular life in these kind of atmospheres?
I think it's just so fascinating, isn't it? Because I think, you know, we understand reasonably well that the laws of physics operate beyond the Earth, and we understand reasonably well that the laws of chemistry operate beyond the Earth, but we don't really know about biology.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Well, obviously we don't, because we haven't discovered life or signs of life anywhere else yet. So I think it is a logical step that we try to explore those environments. And yes, it's because they're fun, of course, but it's also because it's, you know, it's absolutely relevant to us and our own existence and how life originated here on Earth and the conditions that were required. And, you know, it really is a logical step in exploration. It's just that we have to leave the planet to do, or a robotic spacecraft leaves the planet in order to do that. But we're still really exploring our environment. Our solar system is our environment.
And understanding how life started here.
Yeah.
So yes, yeah, so actually that brings me really nicely to this, because you've touched on it already, but the fact that you are working on projects that have got really, really long lifespans. So not only does it take a really long time to get the whole kind of, you know, you have to organize it and everything has to be built and so on and so forth. And then you go and catapult this thing off into space and you kind of have to wave goodbye to it. You can't go and fix it. And then it takes years to get to where it's going to. And then you've got to, you know, wait for all this data to come back. Is that scary sometimes? Is it?
Yeah, it's a funny thing. I mean, I've been really fortunate to be working on multiple different projects, and I've stepped into them at different stages of their cycle. JUICE is the one where I stepped in at the beginning. So that's the one I've sort of lived from the beginning. And I have a very clear benchmark in my mind, because I know that I was quite heavily pregnant with my son when I went to the first meeting. He sits his GCSEs next year. So that's the context for that. And then it'll be another 10 years until we're getting the data back from the mission. So you're talking 25 years for an outer planet mission. And that's just the start of the science phase, right? So that's a really long time. That's a significant fraction of a career. Is it scary? I think from the BEPI point of view, you know, that's the experience that I have. And I know the technical team would tell you, yes, it's very scary. One of the technicians I can remember said to me, you know, it's a bit like getting your mobile phone and sticking it in a drawer for 7 years and then pulling it out and just it needs to work. That's a good way of looking at it. So it has to be built and tested again to such high precision. It's such specialist work that it can then survive launch, survive the cruise that takes, in BEPI's case, 7 years to get to Mercury, heading towards the sun, which is a fairly challenging environment, isn't it? Heading towards the star at the center of our solar system. All of those things the team have prepared that instrument for. It's been designed to operate in those conditions. We check in with the instrument every 6 months or so to see how things are going, and we're able to talk to the instrument in terms of its software. But you're right, in terms of, you know, you can't go and fix something that goes wrong. So you just have to make sure that at the point of launch that you're confident that nothing's going to go wrong. You know, there's a risk. I think the other thing is the preparing the way for the future generation of scientists. So, you know, I might, if there's a mission coming up in future to Uranus or Neptune, which is one of the things which is on the agenda for NASA and for European Space Agency, I'd love the chance to get involved, to help in any way that I might be helpful, maybe defining what those missions would look like, say. But it's unlikely that I'll still be working at the point that those missions happen, because it takes a really long time to get to Uranus and Neptune. But that's not the point, actually. The point is that scientists that have the expertise based on what they've already done then help design the next missions. And then, like me, I stepped into Cassini just as it was arriving at Saturn So, you know, the new scientists come through and they step into the mission and they do the work at the science faves. It's a very long life cycle and it's a very important aspect of what we do, and one which I certainly appreciate working in it. But I think it's really important to understand that that's how it works.
What's the impact of your work? What does your research mean for the person on the street?
So, I mean, in terms of impact, I think, first of all, as we've just been talking about, to some extent, science is inspirational. And I think, you know, we've just been through a global pandemic, right? Absolute evidence of the requirement for scientists and experts. And, you know, we must inspire the younger generation from all backgrounds so that we don't miss out on any of that talent to study science and to become scientists. And however we do that, whichever way we can hook them in, we should do it. Because just because they might come in interested in planets doesn't mean they'll end up being planetary scientists. They might end up studying medicine, right? So it's just about encouraging people to ask those questions. You know, why does physics work out at Jupiter, and is biology the same in a subsurface ocean? All those things that are inspiring, I think that's really important. So for me, that is impact. And if we talk about what we do and we do that well at all different levels, to government in our research papers, but also to the public, then that's really important. And I think that's a significant part of what impact means to me. And of course, again, the development of the technology, the satellite side of things, enables us to monitor our own planet. And of course, that's of vital importance. You know, it's probably the most important thing. We need to understand our own planet, our climate, and what we're doing to it. That's ultimately, you know, the most pressing issue of our time.
Emma, it has been such a pleasure talking to you. We will absolutely have to get back to you when JUICE launches and hear more about that.
Definitely. It's been great talking to you.
Citizen Sounds, University of Leicester. Visit le.ac.uk.